If you want to learn more about the topics of today's episode, visit the podcast website at naturesecretservice.com. Thanks for listening. Okay, people, listen up. Here we go. This is Nature's Secret Service, the podcast that puts you in the room with the men and women of wildlife law enforcement. I'm Ed Newcomer, your host. Today, our guest is Jeff Babauta, former wildlife officer with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. He has an astounding 35-year career in public service with the state of Florida. 25 years of those were as a sworn wildlife officer with the state. He retired in 2019. I first heard about Jeff maybe, I don't know, a year or so ago, and I immediately knew I wanted to have him on the podcast. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us. You're joining us from your home in Florida. I really appreciate you taking the time to do that. Welcome to Nature Secret Service.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
We're going to talk about something I think really fun today because, as you know, before you came on the show, I actually asked you, I said, hey, make sure you go back and listen to our very first episode, because our first episode was with a retired U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service agent named Marie Palladini, who worked on alligator trafficking cases early in her career. And I think it's so fascinating that you kind of closed out your career working on an alligator trafficking case.
Yes, it was. It was just something that, started like 4 years prior to retirement.
Yeah. Amazing. And if you think about it, that's like a 40-year span between what she was working on and what you worked on, which is pretty cool. So to catch us up a little bit, before we jump into the investigation you worked on as a state officer in Florida, catch us up a little bit. If I remember right, your operation kind of kicked off around 2015. If you can kind of tell us what was the situation with alligators in Florida at that time, what's their status? Why are they a concern for this Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission? Just give us some background.
Well, as you know, with Marie's case, she fell into it right when they put the alligator in the endangered species list,
right
back in the 70s, early 70s. And then by the time I came on as an officer, the conservation practice was very successful, that the state of Florida began a alligator hunt, public hunts, which still goes on till today. But then we started trying to get more farmers involved in the state of Florida. So the state of Florida began a farming program to where, private individuals can farm alligators for their hide and their meat and all that. And on top of that, they can also produce eggs that'll, add to their farm. As in Louisiana, they do the same program, except the farmers there need to put back a certain percentage, if I'm not mistaken, back into the wild population. So what caused our investigation was we did an inspection of all the farmers throughout the state of Florida, and we were getting all this data that wasn't, using the word, it wasn't jiving with what the wild population and our biologists is saying, that it's not sustainable for these numbers that these farmers were turning in. They were having like 110% hatch rates. Mm. They're producing all these hatchlings and returning it to their ponds to raise and all that. So I kind of threw up a red flag with our staff, or especially our inspectors. And they kind of thought, maybe what if these alligator eggs were being taken through these farms and sold illegally, or they were being funneled through the farms, and that's how they're getting all these hatch rates. So that's when I came into the picture.
Interesting. Let me back up just a little bit. So there's a couple of cool points here. One is, you know, because alligators had been listed on the Endangered Species Act, and law enforcement officers like Marie Palladini and Florida state officers, Louisiana state officers, and other federal officers worked so diligently on this in the, you know, 70s, alligators recovered to the point where they actually became commercially viable. That, I think, is a really interesting, cool thing.
Yes.
Not only
yes.
are they in the wild, but they actually can now be farmed, and it sounds like they're very closely right. regulated by the state. But I'm a little confused. This so it sounds like the numbers in the paperwork aren't matching up with your inspectors, like the too high of a hatch rate for these farms. So what's the suspicion? Is it that they're going out and they're supplementing their stock by taking eggs from the wild?
Yes, and then they're being laundered through the alligator farms and being sold that way.
Got it.
So, like I said, that's when the agency decided we needed to do a little bit more thorough investigation on what's happening.
So,
and so that's when I came into the picture, and they asked me to, you know, to go undercover to do this.
Very cool. Now, there's a funny aspect to this about you going undercover, but first I want to ask you just, you know, in your experience as a state officer, certainly as a Fed, this kind of laundering that you're discussing, where you take wild and you put it into a farmed situation and then you make it look like it was raised on a farm,
yes.
very common with a lot of different animals where there is this crossover between wild and a farmed or what they call captive raised. You know, in the feds, we see it with primates, we see it with all kinds of reptiles, different types of mammals. I assume the same for you working for the state. It's a problem, right? If you have a captive breeding program and a wild population, inevitably there's going to be that temptation for people to take from the wild and launder it through their captive systems.
Yeah, and like I said, our biologists saw that, you know, you take a wild alligator, which a lot of the wild alligators that make it to these farms are actually our nuisance alligators.
Interesting.
Our farmers are allowed to take those gators, raise them in a commercial environment, if you will, an enclosed environment. When you do that with a wild alligator, that is just not natural. So when we get these numbers that are 100% hatch rate, or they're telling you that, you know, they may have a quarter acre pond, for instance, but the numbers are coming in that they're raising 125 alligators in that quarter acre pond, we were seeing these really crazy numbers. And so, you know, we did a little bit more thorough investigation by sending out more of our inspectors to go visit all these facilities. And they came back, and that's when our colonel decided to let's go ahead and do a covert operation, see what's going on.
Real quick, what's a nuisance alligator? I think I know, but explain what that is.
A nuisance alligator would be one, like, especially during March, April. That's the breeding season, and you're going to find alligators as moving from one pond to another, or Florida, probably just like where you're at, it's expanding, it's booming. So we're taking all these lands that used to be wild lands and putting, you know, 250 homes in it. And so these are chasing all your wild animals that used to live in that environment into golf courses, into these communities where these homes are. So people find them in their swimming pools, in their front yard, underneath a parking lot, or underneath a car in a parking lot. So that's when we get called in. But we started getting, because it was such a success rate, we were getting so many calls on these nuisance alligators that the state started a nuisance trapper program where private individuals can now come in and they take care of a lot of those nuisance alligators too. So we can concentrate on more important things with our wildlife.
Got it.
Like I said, the farmers then How they make their money, the trappers, is we don't pay them anything.
I see.
What they do for us as far as catching these nuisance alligators, that's how they source out their revenue, by selling it to farmers or butchering it themselves and then selling the hide and the meat and, you know, whenever the price is right, of course.
Yeah, okay. So I'm sure that's something else that's heavily regulated by your agency, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so your command staff comes to you and says, hey, Jeff, we think there's a problem here. We want you to go on undercover. You're kind of at the end of your career. What's your first thoughts on when that happens to you?
Well, here's what started the whole thing. You know, as law enforcement officers, we have a continuing education. Mm. And I've taken so many courses and classes that I saw a covert operation course being put on by our agency, which actually attracts other fish and wildlife agencies to Florida to take this course. So I had like 4 years left, and I decided, you know, that'd be something cool for me to do. I have no intention of going undercover. It was just something that looked like fun. So I took the course. Evidently, I did well, because about a year later, and later on, I find out, by the way, that this is pretty much how they pick people to go undercover.
Uh-huh.
And so I get a call, several calls. And the first time I received the call, I not only said no, but I said, hell no, because I'm fixing to go retire. And I don't want to get hurt or injured before I retire. So the calls kept coming. So it wasn't until like the third or fourth call when they said, hey, we know you're going to retire here in a few years, but if you were successful with this, how would you like to go out with a bang?
No kidding.
I'll meet with command staff.
Okay.
But I don't know. I had to talk to the wife, which, of course, she didn't like the idea neither.
Sure.
So I met with them. And usually when you do something like this, it's so secretive. There's only a couple handful of command staff that will meet with
right.
you. But then they don't ever tell you what you're going to do. So I agreed to a one-year being out of uniform. To the covert operation, and as long as I committed to 1 year, then they would go back, have their little meeting. Anyways, it got all approved.
Okay.
But prior to leaving the command staff that day, the last thing they told me was, you might want to grow your hair out.
Yeah.
Because I'm not your ordinary. You know, I look Hawaiian, Asian. Most people have Mexican. No, most people have no clue what my background is. So I do stand out. I really stand out, especially within my community. If you say this Asian, Hawaiian looking guy, which incidentally, I'm originally from Guam, they'll say, oh, yeah, that's the guy that checked me.
Right.
Versus, you know, a blonde hair, blue eyed game warden. So I stood
right.
out. So when they told me you might want to grow your hair out, grow a goatee, a beard, whatever, because you're going to go deep under, I didn't realize later on that the county that I was going to be assigned to do this covert operation was right next door to
mine. Oh, geez.
And I've worked this area.
Oof.
But still, at the time when they ask you to do this, they don't tell you that.
Interesting.
So the very first thing that I did actually prior to this, and I kind of took it as a field training program where I got to learn how to use different tools and audio equipment and video recordings. And so the first thing I actually did was, we had an issue with soft-shell turtles in Central Florida, and that already had an investigation going on, and kind of determined that the problem is pretty close by to where I'm going to be assigned to. So me and my assigned lieutenant at the time, my covert lieutenant, went and kind of did a little bit of surveillance on this individual that was involved with these Chinese people that had opened up a turtle farm
okay.
here in Okeechobee. And we kind of had some suspicion that people were bringing turtles over there, not necessarily just all softshell turtles, but box turtles and other turtles, snapping snappers. Turtles. But they're really after softshell turtles. So when we were doing this surveillance on this one individual, we were driving past his house and we saw a dog box in the front of his house, which meant he's a big dog hunter. Mm. More than likely, he's a big hog hunter.
Right. Using dogs to hunt, right?
Yeah. Correct. So we pulled into his driveway, knocked on the door, and we use this excuse that we own a my lieutenant at the time owned a landscaping business, and I was one of the employees, and we were wanting to know if he would sell us a hog for a big gathering that we're going to have.
Perfect.
And prior to pulling into his house, we just happened to have a huge turtle in the back of our truck. And as a, you know, we made agreements of the price, the whole bit. So now the guy's following us out to the truck and he hears that thing scratching the back of the turtle or the truck, looks back there and he sees a softshell turtle. Uh-huh. And he immediately says, "Man, where did you get that thing?" And it was a pretty large turtle. And I told him, I said, you know, up at our shop where we, you know, sharpen all our equipment, our lawnmower blades, and repair all our equipment for the landscaping business, there's this huge pond. And I found this turtle when it was outside of the pond, and I captured it. Didn't know what to do with it. And I said, you want it? He goes, "Shoot, yeah, man, I'll take that thing. I know a guy that I can sell them to." So that's what started the whole thing.
Interesting.
Then I began going out and we hooked up with an individual that was complaining about, he was a commercial farmer or a commercial fisherman, I'm sorry, that his area that he normally catches all these turtles were, you know, the numbers weren't right. He felt like somebody was raping the waters, in his words.
So he's feeling like he's not catching as much as he should. Yeah,
correct.
Too few.
And he knew that there was something going on and that anyways, he wanted to help us out,
okay.
help Florida Fish and Wildlife. So he volunteered to help me get turtles. So I would leave my home, this prior before me even going completely under, I would leave my home early in the morning at 4 o'clock and I'd meet him. He was about an hour and a half from me and We'd go out and we'd set these trout lines. You know, he told me what one time it was anywhere from 3/4 to a mile long trout.
Yeah, explain what a trout line is for people who might not.
Trout line is a set of lines with all these drop lines on it with hooks,
yeah.
And you bait them and you release them out in the water, and you can make a loop along the shoreline however you want to set it up. And you can catch everything from his targets were softshell turtles and catfish. So he would catch a few of the turtles for us. And, you know, I could see what he was complaining about because, you know, for us to set out, let's just say we set out 500 lines, 500 hooks, we'd be lucky if we caught 10 turtles. Mm.
Normally, what would you catch if things were
mostly catfish?
No, I mean, assuming things were not going downhill for turtles, how many would you have expected on a 500 hook?
Oh, he, you know, in the old days, he would tell me him and his daddy back in the old days would catch anywhere from 60 to 100 easily every couple of days. So he had a legitimate complaint that there was something happening. So I will take those turtles now and take it to that individual that was selling it to the Hispanic guy. And we would take it out back to in the back of his house. And he had all these huge cattle troughs. And he put a little bit of water in it. And he put all these turtles in it. And he had all these palm fronds on top of the troughs to keep them in the shade until his person would come and pick them up and then pay him. So that went on for a few days or a few weeks. But the very first time that we did that, as we left his home, we had an idea of the vehicle that these people were driving, these Chinese people, and it was a blue van. And as we were leaving the individual's house, guess what passes us? It was a blue van. And so we knew that that connection was, we hit it just right. Yeah. So anyways, this went on for several weeks. And then after about maybe 3 months of this is when the agency decided to take them down, because we had then discovered that they were leaving Florida, going all the way up to New York. And then they were being put in a container alive in from New York and then being shipped to China, where they're considered a delicacy.
So you kind of use this turtle case to kind of get yourself ready to go into the bigger alligator case, right?
Yes. And I'm glad I did. Looking back at some of the photos and the way I taped the individual, you know, we're standing in front of the scale, because he was paying me by the pound. Mm. And I've got these tools that we would use. Actually, it was a key fob that had a camera in it and a tape recorder, and I could tape everything that's going on. So after a few months of that, maybe 4 or 5 months, we decided to wrap it up. We followed them up to New York and determined that we needed to go ahead and take them down. So the I wasn't a part of that takedown. So right after the takedown, we had a little meeting, and that's when they threw me a set of keys. And they said, here's your real operation. Remember, they haven't told me what I was going to go undercover.
You still didn't know at this point it was going to be alligators.
No,
interesting.
No,
okay.
No.
Okay.
Yeah. So I catch the keys, and there's a note attached to it, and this is the address. And I said, what is it? And he said, that's the address. Go look at this place. So I go to a town here called Arcadia, and I go to this address, and I open the gate, and they gave me the combination, and it's a dump.
Mm.
They had already rented a 9-acre piece of property, it had three ponds on the property, and so I called them up, and I said, what is this place?
Yeah.
And they said, you're going to turn that into an alligator farm.
Now, this is the first you've heard of what you're going to be doing undercover work on.
The very first time. They don't tell you
that,
anything.
Why? What? That is so foreign to me.
It's just that secretive that they're afraid that I'm going to pull out and, you know, start telling everybody, hey, they asked me to go undercover to open up this alligator farm. I don't know. It wasn't. They didn't want to take their chances.
That really strikes me as so odd that never would happen in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife. We would always involve the undercover person at the very beginning of developing an operation. It's just such a strange way to operate. I don't understand the logic, but you know, well, that's the way they do it.
Pretty much worked out, because they told me that anything that has to do with alligators, you're going to
okay.
do it. You're going to start with this farm, and you're going to – what we're interested in is alligator eggs.
I see.
And I'm like, I've never even seen an alligator egg. You know, during – as a normal patrol officer, as a normal game warden, that wasn't anything we really did. We have inspectors in the agency that go and evaluate all these farmers or inspect them.
Right.
So I've never even really seen – I've caught hundreds, literally hundreds of alligators.
Right, as part of your job,
The nuisance gators, all that. But I've never really seen an alligator.
Interesting.
So like everybody else, I Googled and got on YouTube how to be an alligator farmer, and I began building this so-called farm. I had to follow the agency's policies on fencing and everything. had to apply for permits, but everything had to be done covertly.
Okay.
Even the inspector that came to inspect my facility, I knew the guy. When they called me and the lieutenant called me and said, hey, I've set you up an inspection. Go ahead and give this guy a call. And he told me the individual's name. I said, man, I know that
guy.
He goes, you're going to have to come out with something.
What was? So you got to keep your cover even with other people.
Within the
agency.
Officers.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
You know, even throughout the academy, when I first joined, even at the academy, they told us about people going undercover. And that if you ever run into somebody
talk to them.
You have any suspicion because they got long hair or something, but even though you're sitting at a bar and you recognize this guy, you just leave.
Yep. Never talk to him.
Nope. So you know that. So what I did was about an hour before he arrived at my facility, I got the hell out of there. And I called him and I said, listen, I've got a family. And I disguised my voice. And I said, I've got a family emergency. All my paperwork is in the barn. You'll find the keys underneath the mat. Perfect. This is a gate combo. Please go help yourself. I'm sorry I couldn't be there. You tell me what all I need.
Perfect.
To open up this farm. And next thing you know, I'm getting my permit.
Nice.
I was lacking a few items. You know, people will circumvent the law. And for a professional farm, for instance, they have raceways, like you would see at fish hatcheries.
Right.
Well, some of the farmers have kind of circumvented that law and started using kiddie swimming pools as their way of raising hatchlings. Well, guess what? I knew the state didn't have they didn't have the funds to really make this operation go right. I did not know how this was even going to work out. Prior to me even becoming a wildlife officer, I worked with Division of Fisheries at a fish hatchery.
Nice.
And I know the background on what it takes to open up a fish hatchery. So that was really my only obstacle to get my farming permit through Florida Fish and Wildlife was I needed to go buy a few more swimming pools.
Gotcha.
So as soon as he called me back and he told me I needed so many pools, I said, how do I get back with you? Because I sure as hell didn't want to go see him again. He said, just send me a receipt.
Perfect.
And a photograph of all the swimming pools.
Perfect.
So I went to every Kmart, every Walmart that where I could buy swimming pools. And that's how I completed my farm, doing it that way.
And you know, you bring up an interesting point because, you know, your agency's asked you to start this undercover business. They're, I assume, going to expect this business to kind of fund itself, right? They're not going to have unlimited financial resources to run it.
No, and I really lucked out there because for a whole year there to begin with, nothing was happening. I mean, I went out and I made business cards. I made this grand entrance. I started to go out and hang out with nuisance trappers. Uh-huh. And I would call nuisance trappers and I was building up my stock. If I found a kiosk at the local tractor supply or at a Walmart, I was pasting my business cards there. I pretty much went with that saying that if you build it, they will come. Uh-huh. So I made placards for my truck in case I did hook up somebody that they would know that this truck belonged to, you know, this individual or whatever. And I just paraded around Arcadia and advertised, you know, who I was.
So I don't want us to run out of time on this discussion because we could probably talk all day about this, Jeff. This is so fascinating. But how your ultimate goal now is to try to figure out who's laundering wild eggs into the system.
Correct.
So how did you make that leap then where you got introduced to somebody who was involved in laundering wild eggs into the captive system?
To begin with, I was visiting other farms.
I see. Okay.
And I was visiting them unannounced. I wanted my name to be put out there. I wanted my farm name to be put out there, which incidentally was called Sunshine Alligator.
Okay.
So this industry is so knitly tight that no, everybody has their own trade secrets. Yeah. So nobody was going to invite me in and say, hey, this is what we do. This is a temperature we use, or this is a feed we use. Nobody was sharing any of that with me. So, you know, when I was going through all that, I was thinking, you know what? This is not, by the way, my UC name, undercover name, was Curtis Blackledge.
Nice.
But when you go undercover, you try and go back to your first original name. Mm-hmm. And so I eventually became Jeff Curtis Blackledge.
Perfect.
To just being Jeff Blackledge. And that's how I would introduce myself. But my driver's license, everything, my bank, my ATM card, everything was Curtis Blackledge.
Got it.
But the reason you do that is in case when you're at a restaurant and one of them officers come in, or your neighbor, and sees you. And says, hey, Jeff, you know, then you can at least automatically respond.
Exactly.
Because then the other guys are like, I thought your name was Curtis.
Exactly. Or, anyway, worst case, the bad guys are yelling, hey, Curtis, and you're not turning around.
That actually happened to me. I stopped by at one of these fast food joints. Uh-huh. And you know how you take their order and they ask you for your name?
Oh, boy, you just stood there waiting.
We're standing there calling this guy Curtis. Finally, this older gentleman nudges me and he goes, hey, man, I think they're calling your order. And she's hollering my name. Oh, yeah, that's me. That's me. That was a test. Well, I learned real quick. That you need to learn your name.
Exactly. So you're making, making friends. And now how are you going to break into the egg business?
I was showing up unannounced, and I'm thinking, you know, this is not me. So I'm just going to swallow my pride. Mm. You know, law enforcement people have a lot of pride. They don't like to be embarrassed or beat in anything. So I just started showing up unannounced, calling people and say, hey, let's do lunch, which none of that was happening. So almost a year later, actually,
wow,
the agency decided to open up the farming industry to even more people, because it was really locked down to only 30 farmers throughout the whole state of Florida. And they were wanting to host a meeting to try and go from 30 to, I believe, 35 farmers throughout the state. And so I happened to be hooking up with an individual close to me that showed up and attended that meeting. I was so scared to go to that meeting because I knew biologists and everybody. But so I sat in the back of the room. And so I saw this individual. And after the meeting, I went to go shake hands with him. And he snubbed me. Boy, he pissed me off. I was like, man, once again, you got to swallow your pride. But to me, it was like, damn, we've been talking to each other for almost a year, talking hunting stories and camping and fishing stories. And you're going to snub me like this? Right. So I was on the way home. I was furious. And guess what? He calls and apologizes. And what he was doing there at the farm, he was running around trying to negotiate deals with other farmers. Mm. Well, nobody wanted to partner up with him. And he knew I was the only one that gave a damn about him. So he calls me. And later on, I find out that he had broken up his partnership with one of the local farms not far from my farm. And he needed a partner quickly. So he calls me up and we meet. And he gives me this, or he made a deal with me that he would like to use my facility. He'd pay me $2,500 up front and $2,500. He was going to pay me $5,000 for the use of my facility. And he was going to be responsible with the airboats, everything, the containers, the vehicle. He would even start getting the permits. Remember, I had no clue how to do any of this.
Right.
In the meantime, I was going out and begging people to let me put in a bid on how much I was going to pay them to go on their private lands, collect the eggs. And back prior to me going undercover, egg prices were anywhere from $5 to $10 an egg. What happened was all those hurricanes had devastated Louisiana. So their population had plummeted. That now they were depending on states like Florida, maybe Georgia and Mississippi, particularly Florida. So egg prices went from $5 to $45
an egg.
An egg.
So there is a
I hit the market right.
There is a legal process for collecting eggs from the wild, right? It just has to be
correct.
Has to be permitted.
You have to be permitted, and there's two ways. One is through a supervised collection, which we had to hire biologists that would look at the nest, and basically you collect this nest, skip this one, collect this one, skip this one. And this way our population stays stable. Yeah. And then the other one is a set number where our biologists would go in and say, this guy's on, I got 5,000 acres. We've already done a census on his property. You're only allowed to collect 250 eggs off this.
Got it.
So it's set. So I met with this guy. He asked me for my social security number, my driver's license, my farm permit, everything. And he takes all this and calls me up a couple of days later, and he says, I need you to come by my house, which only lived like maybe 2.5 miles from my house, my UC home. And so I go to his house, and he on his kitchen table, he's got all these folders and paperworks of all these management areas and public hunt areas that I'm familiar with. I've worked
with. As a game warden,
And places like Avon Park Bombing Range, which has like 600,000 acres, I believe, over there. So anyways, I'm saying, hey, what is all this? And he goes, this is where we're going to start collecting. I said, how are you going to go through all this? He goes, I'll show you. Mm. So I go on vacation to keep the wife happy. I told her this thing is fixing to go down. We love to go camping. So we took off to North Carolina and went camping for a week. Made up another cover story with the bad guys. You know, I got to go meet my girlfriend's parents.
Right.
And we're going to go meet in some cabin up in North Carolina. So when you tell a lie, I think you know this. When you tell a lie, you better know something about that lie.
You know, that'd be
like my cover stories, for example, I'm from a small fishing village here in our coastal, just north of where I live here in Florida. And so if they ever ask me, hey, have you ever been down to Bubba's Bar and Grill next to Shell Point Road? I was, oh, yeah, I've been there numerous times, even though I've never been there.
At least so you know where it is.
You tell a lie. Yeah. So I tell them we're going to go up to North Carolina Mountains just in case it's, oh, man, we used to camp, you know, in North Carolina, da-da-da. So anyway, long story short, I'm on my way home. And my UC phone, my undercover phone, kept going off, kept blowing up on emails. And it's from FWC, Florida Fish and Wildlife.
Okay.
Congratulations, you got the permit, and you got the bid on this property. Congratulations, you got this property. And I'm like, man, I never applied for any of these things. And so I called the supervisor. I said, I think the individual's name was Robert. I said, I think Robert just hijacked my damn farm. He goes, what do you mean? I said, He has applied for all these permits. There must be 25, 30 properties he applied for under Sunshine Alligator Farm, a.k.a. Curtis Blackledge.
Mm-hmm.
I said to myself, I'm not going to complain. I want to see how far this goes.
Yeah, for sure.
So anyways, the collection permits begin. We start collecting eggs. Especially from one of our own wildlife management areas. And the way that the collection starts is you go to a gate and you got to call FWC and say, hey, it's Curtis Blackledge. I'm arriving at such and such gate on the southeast entrance of such and such property. I'm going into, and so everything's documented.
Right.
Through our agency. They had absolutely no clue that was another way of us documenting, because as you leave, now you have to tell them how many eggs you've collected.
Got it.
So what we were doing was, for example, even if we had a biologist with us, we were collecting every single nest along the way. We weren't skipping nothing.
Okay.
And so if we were supposed to collect, let's say, 250 eggs from one property, no, we'd steal like 350, maybe 400.
Okay. So
but pay the landowner.
Yeah.
That $45 for the 250 bucks.
Or
250 eggs. We would pay him, but we would steal the other eggs. And they would all end up at my farm. Our management areas, where there's a set number we're supposed to collect. Once we get to the gate, we're supposed to call dispatch again and say, hey, it's Curtis Blackledge. I'm leaving the place. And it tells you what time you're leaving as well. And then today we collected 200, where I witnessed us collecting 500. Okay. So all this was coming back to the farm. And this thing hit so quick. And the good thing about this was Robert offered to pay for it. Everything.
Perfect.
And thank goodness.
Agency didn't have to come up with anything.
I couldn't afford the containers he was bringing me to put these eggs in, you know, and I wasn't going to just call the agency and say, hey, I need 50 grand to get this thing off the ground. We don't have that kind of money. Yeah. So he offered to do everything, even hiring a helicopter. We flew helicopters.
What?
Recorded all the nests from the air and jotted it down on our GPSs. He furnished all the airboats, and thank goodness, because I don't even know we had an unmarked airboat that I could have used. Plus, I did not want anything to ever make it look like I was a game horn. So I didn't even dare drive an airboat.
Right.
I didn't want to get out there and all of a sudden I get a flashback and I'm doing all my doodads and them say, where the hell did he learn how to drive an airboat?
Exactly.
I wonder if this dude's a game warden, undercover game warden. So I stayed away from all that. But my gosh, he paid for everything.
So there's enough money. This Robert guy kind of appears out of nowhere because you're the only farm that'll really work with him. But he's got enough money. There's enough money and eggs.
No, it wasn't him. It wasn't him.
Who's funding?
We later find out.
Yeah, who's funding this helicopter?
It's probably the largest alligator producer in the United States. It's up in Louisiana.
No kidding.
The place is called Godin Ranch, but I will say they were innocent out of this whole thing.
Okay.
We later find out that Robert, remember, he had a partnership down here, not far from my business. Mm. This Godin Ranch used to come down and buy eggs from him and hatchlings, and take it back. So there was already a business established. Well, remember, Robert broke away from the partnership. And this guy just happened to hire Robert. Hey, if you can get me some hatchlings, I don't know how you're going to do it. I will make a deal with you. You get me some hatchlings, and I'm planning on expanding my operation down there in Arcadia.
Wow.
And you will be responsible for this. This was all found out. We find this all out later.
Okay.
So Robert had all this connection that he could just say, hey, send Ed a check for $15,000. I just bought so many eggs from him, and they would do that. They would just send you a check for $15,000. And the only reason we found that out is I got a call one night after we're putting all this stuff together and said, do you know a so-and-so? I said, no. Mm. They would go out, our investigators, and go interview this guy. I said, no, I don't know nothing about alligator eggs. I build airboats. Mm. I build the hulls for airboats. And that hull costs $15,000, for example.
I see.
We go to another guy. Hey, what do you build? Oh, I build the cages. He was building his own airboats using that guy. He was ripping him off.
Wow.
That opened up a whole another can of worms. Huh. So anyways, after we get all these things, the agency's calling me. And remember, your job basically as a undercover is to observe and report.
Exactly. Document, write
reports. Yeah. And so at first, I was having to come home a lot. And it's about an hour and a half ride. write my reports and go back. Well, I got tired of that. And when my lieutenant found this out later on, he was mad. But I began building false walls in my camper. By the way, I didn't tell you, I ended up living in a camper
on the property.
Yeah. The idea behind that is if we need to go collect eggs way down in the Everglades, I can hook on our camper. And instead of the agency paying for a hotel, I've got a camper I can stay in. So I began building false walls in the camper, in the barn. And this way I could put my personal wallet in there, my cell phone, my keys, and my computer. I would write the reports right there on site. And I damn near got caught one day because my gate's about 100 yards from the gate to where my camper was set up in the barn.
Okay.
That I began putting up the motion, the alarm. But birds were also setting those off.
I see.
So now I went and bought this, it's metal. It picks up basically your car frame. And you bury it in the ground, and it sends a signal from the module to the camper. Because one day, I was sitting in the table typing in my report, and I hear a car door slam. I look out the damn window. It's one of the bad guys that I hung out with as well. Shit. So I grabbed my damn computer, and I threw it underneath my bed. And, hey, man, what's up? You know, shake hands. Hey, you want a beer? Come on in. Sit down. And since then, I was really, really very careful then. Mm. So that's how I started writing the report. So like I said, my job was to observe it, report it, let the command staff figure out what we're doing.
Right, right.
So then comes the hatching season. We're collecting eggs. I had over $750,000 worth of eggs in my farm.
Wow.
And in the corner, I had what I dubbed the poacher's corner. While I was gone out in the field, and I knew this was going to happen because I had asked for additional help months earlier, and they kept saying, no, no, no. That's how secretive it is. They didn't want nobody else involved. Right. Well, every time I'd come home at night, I'd see more eggs that I know wasn't there in the morning. And by the way, I had cameras everywhere.
I'll bet. Okay.
I started using those game cameras, the older ones, not the cell ones.
Okay.
And I put them up all over the place and to see what was coming and going. They thought that I was doing it because at the time my farm, we had partnered up. There was a lot of farms that were being, eggs were being stolen.
I see.
So that was another cover story. Hey, I'll buy the camera so nobody breaks into our place. But literally they know I was using that because I was downloading it every day, especially when I'd come back from and I'd see there's more eggs in the corner. Where the hell did that come? I pull my camera and hell, here's these guys walking in with all these crates. And I could tell which individual brought it and all that. And then on inside the barn, we had these little tiny cameras about the size of my pinky fingernail that fit perfectly inside the tool boards. You know, those boards with all the
pegboard. Yeah.
Yep. The pegboards. And the problem with that is when I hear the alarm off going off at the gate, I had to run out in the barn and turn them all
right,
on.
Right.
That's just how technology was back then. So now I've got all this data. We're hatching out all these eggs. We collected almost 13,000 eggs.
And
I think we were the third largest in the state of Florida.
Of these are legally collected, and a lot of them are not.
A lot of them are not.
And they're now, sneaking in and supplementing your supply with illegal eggs, I assume, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
And throughout the whole time, Robert had this metal case underneath his arm. He never turned that thing loose. And you know as well as I do, every criminal organization has some kind of paperwork somewhere. Yeah. Well, that's where it was hidden.
The metal case.
And I had an opportunity to get to that case and started snapping pictures of it. And that was the first time I ever went up to Louisiana. And that would have never happened because Robert at the time had also hired another buddy of his that worked at the last farm that they worked at. And only he and Robert were going to go up to Louisiana. Well, I wanted to see this place.
Yeah. So why are you going to Louisiana? Take the hatchlings up there to
yeah. Because remember, yeah, it's going to the farms. I got paid for everything. Yeah. That all belonged to okay. him. $2,500 or the $5,000 he was going to pay for me. Or to me, that was also coming from
But
him.
As far as this Louisiana guy knows, he's only getting legal hatchlings from Florida.
Yep.
Right.
Yep,
okay.
Yep. He didn't know any of this others.
Got it.
Anything else, any other hanky-panky.
Got it. Okay.
So, I'm sorry. Going back to, I was asking for help. I started seeing all these extra things. I was pulling my camera and said, I'm telling you, I need extra eyes.
Yeah.
So they brought in another officer. Quickly just to, and they told him what was going to happen. Next thing you know, he's coming up to my place. But prior to coming to my place, I had called the agency and I said, or my lieutenant, and I said, hey, do we have an unmarked utility train? Uh-huh. He goes, I believe one just came in that one of our field offices. What do you need it for? I said, bring it to me. I said, I'm gonna try and finagle my way to go to Louisiana. He goes, how are you going to do that? I said, Robert already has plans with him and the other individual's name is Tommy. Him and Tommy were the only ones who were going to go. So they brought me that trailer. That new officer brought me that trailer. We got to meet each other that night. And so I planted that trailer on the property. And every day that Robert would come in, he finally, like after the second or third day, he asked me, he goes, man, whose trailer is that? And I said, that's mine. What are you going to do with it? And we all knew that we all loved to go uh-huh. hunt. So I told him, I said, man, I found that I bought it from this old lady. Her husband died and he was going to convert it into a camper. Well, that's what I'm going to do with it. I'm going to put a little Coleman stove in there, a bed, da, 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 da. And I said, why, you have any use for it? He goes, man, that'd be the perfect way to haul these hatchlings up. Because they were just going to throw it in the back of the truck. And I'd already warned him that, man, it's hot. Yeah. You know, you're traveling. Well, I later find out Robert only wanted to travel at yep. night. And I think the reason was he could bypass all these agriculture stations.
And exactly. All the ag check stations will be closed.
And, yeah. So anyways, I told him, I said, yeah, we can take it, but I've got to go because it's all registered to me that I don't take any chances. He goes, okay, you can go. And that's how I got to go up
there. Perfect.
So we ended up making three trips up there, taking over 10,000 hatchlings and dropping it off. And my gosh, you ought to see that facility up there.
Mm, huge. Huh?
It's the size of a Walmart
no kidding.
Shopping center, 60-some thousand square foot. Hell, they use a bobcat to pick up ice and to put ice in all the carts where all the meat's being skinned. Wow. And all that. What they do to it or with it, Robert tells me, is he's got a tannery. This Golden Ranch has a tannery over in Italy. And all these alligators were going to the fashion industry.
Which
wallets, purses.
Ironically, that is exactly what Special Agent Marie Palladini described 40 years earlier.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. You're right. I remember that now. But no, those were going to China.
They were going to Europe for fashion handbags, but also Japan, I believe.
Yeah. Japan. Yeah. I knew it was an Asian country. Yeah. But yeah, this way, if a company like Louis Vuitton calls and says, hey, I need 2,000 four-footers. They take the hide over there and tan it purple, pink, blue, whatever Louis Vuitton wants. And now he's got all these expensive meat, too.
Right.
Because they have a special formula that I was told Purina scientists or whatever from Purina designed this to raise these things. Alligators are rated by their skin. It's a 1 to 5, and I believe one is like the best or something, vice versa. I don't remember, but he raises nothing but the best hides in the world.
So,
because when we drop off these hatchlings, they're in a little, I don't know, let's just say a 20 by 20 room, and we'll dump like 500 or 600 hatchlings, you know, 8-inch hatchlings in this room, and they live in complete darkness to where they're not scratching one another.
Right, no scars.
No scars or scar free. Actually, even while we were raising this at my farm, we were putting this chemical. It's actually for chickens that cures diseases. Mm. And we tried to force them to hatch out. We would help them hatch out, but we didn't want the umbilical cord scarring their belly. Wow. That's how critical we were, even down here at my operation.
Okay.
That we didn't want. So we're putting all these chemicals. We found one that was really the umbilical cord had really scarred their bellies. We put them in a little bit stronger tub to kind of close that gap and make the hide a lot
interesting.
Better.
Okay.
So we would take all these up. We made 3 trips all the way up there. And that part of it was pretty wild, because I don't know that it's ever been done through our agency that we've gone out of state like that.
Yeah, and that's a logistical nightmare when you do that, because I assume you had some cover. You had a cover team, right?
Even down to the tracker.
Yeah.
You know, we had the old heavy trackers that you could put up underneath the car frame. Well, I didn't want to get caught doing that, because they told me to just leave it in the trailer. I said, no, I'm not going to do that. I said, I break an axle.
Yeah.
And we throw all that in the back. The tracker's there on the side of I-75.
Right.
So I said, no, here's what we're going to do. Get on the computer. Call me. I'm just going to put it in my damn overnight
there
bag.
You go.
I put it between my jeans, wrapped it, because they were trying to tell me it's not going to go through the roof of the truck. I said, go look
at
it. And they called me back and goes, no, we can see you. You're at the farm.
Okay, perfect.
So it's going to work. So I said, I don't know what else y'all going to do, but we're headed up to Louisiana in a couple hours. You do whatever you – and that's the other thing. Robert would never say, we're leaving next Tuesday at 6 p.m. And the reason he wanted to leave at night was, like I said, he wanted to bypass all those stations. So we put a huge bladder in the back – a diesel tank in the back of his truck. I think it held an extra 100 gallons of fuel.
Hmm.
And I wired up the whole tank with the pump. That we would just pull into a rest area, open up our fuel or our diesel tank and fill up from there. We didn't even stop at a gas station.
Wow, okay.
He wanted to get these things up there.
Yeah.
You know, to me, we were legal because he had the legal transportation documents to go all the way up, because I was taking photographs of everything.
Yep.
So that's how we made it up. And that was one way that I was able to get to that container. And I guess everyone that was following us, they would take turns and just I'd get to, maybe after 2.5 hours of driving, another group of officers would come in and follow us, and the plan was, you guys stay at least 5 miles behind us, just keep an eye on your computer.
Yeah.
And this is basically for my safety, that they found out I was working undercover. We could be crossing one of those Louisiana bridges, and they just throw my body over the bridge. I don't know. But they followed us all the way up to Louisiana and back
Wow.
home. And I would have to keep track either way, that for the most part, Robert didn't drive. He'd drive us, at, you know, when we'd leave, and we'd get up maybe 2 hours later. And I picked up a quick habit with Robert. Anytime he put his arms up on the steering wheel and hugged the steering wheel and his head's up on his wrist, I'd be looking at him and saying, oh, my God, it's time for me to drive. And he'd look at me and go, hey, man, you want to drive?
Yeah.
And it's a 14-hour trip up, 14 hours back. We didn't spend the night.
Yeah, because he just
so – one of those times, I was up for like 52 hours. I was living off those 5-hour drinks,
yeah.
Those energy
He
drinks.
Just wanted to move the product as quickly as possible and give back.
Get back because, we were also hatching
more.
Yeah.
Yeah. So was it 10,000 per trip or 10,000 total?
No. It was between 3,000 and 4,000 per
trip. So what's the value of that? These are hatchlings now. What's the value of 10,000 hatchlings?
By then, they're about $100 a piece.
Ooh, that's a lot of money.
Each hatchling.
That's a lot of money.
Each hatchling.
So you've got, now what you've documented here really well is, you know, this illustrates what an undercover business is, so why it's so helpful and why it's so good to use. Because what you've documented here is the system that is being used to illegally harvest from the wild to disguise it with quote unquote legal paperwork to make it look legal. And then right. The classic laundering across state lines to an innocent buyer who probably doesn't know anything about the fact that these have been illegally collected. And there's no other way that a law enforcement officer could document the scope of the problem without doing what you did. And so I assume you've got Robert, and now you've got cases also against all these other people who were collecting for him and bringing eggs to your place.
Yes.
So how did this wrap up? We're getting short on time. How many people did you end up, how'd the case come to a close, and how many people did you charge?
Well, it didn't really closed then. The agency, I was ready to go
home. I'll bet.
The agency called and said, hey, will you stay in a few more months? I said, what's a few months? What's going on now? Well, we have these individuals selling alligators out of the Indian reservation, which is illegal. So I did that for an extra 3 months.
Okay.
And so I thought there was 11 people involved.
Okay.
During the whole operation, you know, this thing happened almost 9 years ago. After we did the takedown, there might have been 14 people involved, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
And Robert ended up serving 3 years.
Nice.
We tried to charge him under the RICO. It's never been done.
Yeah, wildlife and RICO is uncommon.
And so they took it through an appeal. Robert went to prison. He decided to go ahead and plea out. But the other four individuals were saying, hey, we didn't collaborate with Robert to do this. This doesn't fall under RICO. So they took it to an appeal. The judge found that actually two things came out of this, that we could not charge them under the RICO statute because the wildlife, you have to be injured financially somehow.
Okay.
Well, Fish and Wildlife doesn't own the Fish and Wildlife in the state of Florida.
Right.
We only manage it. So what they done now, because we even tried to go through with the Lacey Act. So now our legislators have passed a new law now that any wildlife leaving the state of Florida, I don't remember the new law that was enacted, but the other guys still ended up going back in for a year to serve their time. Because I had one individual, for example, that shot a white ibis while I was fixing lunch, and I look out my camper window and he's doing his G.I. Joe crawl after he just told me or asked me, you ever eat one of them birds? And I said, man, hell no. I said, are those things protected? So anyway, he shoots one of these things and I'm screaming mad. I come out and I'm videotaping him, by the way, with that fob telling you about. And I said, what the F are you doing, man? I said, the gunshot, the game wardens are coming. God damn, we got this endangered bird you just shot. So guess how he gets rid of it? He takes the carcass after we cut the carcass out. And I just happened to be barbecuing some bubble burgers. And we cut the carcass out. I put a little bit of lime juice on it and some seasoning, threw it on the grill. He took the carcass, threw it in the alligator pond for the alligators to eat up the evidence before the game ward came. You know. So anyways, the other guys were charged with possession, without permits, all that. So they ended up serving a year out of that. And more than anything, Robert and they all have to pitch in and pay back over $100,000 in fines, pay back Fish and Wildlife for all the eggs that was stolen out of the management areas, because throughout that whole collection, there's also egg fees that was supposed to have been paid to the agency. Right. None of that was ever followed up. So they ended up paying over $100,000+ in fines, and that's going to be for the rest of their lives.
Sure. And jail time, which is good. So you have them on the record. They have a record. Yeah. And the new law you mentioned, I assume, is to make it easier in the future to bring RICO charges if necessary. Is that idea?
That is where.
And then with the IBIS, you're just documenting any other crimes they commit. You know, funny you mentioned that he threw it to get rid of evidence. He threw it into the alligator ponds for them to eat. I've been on saltwater crocodile farms in Southeast Asia. And the first thing that popped into my mind was, you know, in Thailand, a huge saltwater crocodile farm. I'm just thinking to myself, I wonder how many murdered people go into that pond, right? Disappear forever. you know, this is a great story, Jeff. I love the way it ties in with Marie Palladini's experience. Let me ask you kind of your opinion as a, you know, former wildlife officer, obviously a professional conservation law enforcement officer. I think sometimes, you know, when it comes to wildlife trafficking, you often hear language out there where people talk about, we've got to end wildlife trafficking. We've got to, you know, eliminate it. I always view that as terribly naive and an unattainable goal. It'd be like saying, okay, we're going to catch murderers so that nobody commits murder anymore. It's just not going to happen. So, you know, when you hear, you know, Marie Palladini works on this case 40 years earlier, and 40 years later, there are still people involved in alligator, you know, egg laundering and trafficking. Does that make you feel like we're losing the battle, or how does that make you feel as a law enforcement officer?
You know, when mine ended, I heard a lot of complaints from other farmers that they knew this was going on. Fish and Wildlife should have never ended this. I could tell that undercover officer where else to go try. You know, we got to come home to our families eventually. Yeah. But no, for the longest time, it's been 10 years now, almost 10 years. It quieted everything down. Everybody, you know, got their act together. Yeah. But you know as well as I do, someone's always going to challenge something else to make it better to do something illegal. Yep. You know, there's always going to be a challenge. But I just had another one of these talks here last week, and somebody actually asked that question. Do you know if this is still going on? Well, I'm kind of out of touch because I've been retired now for so long, going on 7 years now, but there just happened to be an officer sitting in my audience.
Nice.
That I actually trained, and I asked him, I said, you know, you tell me, I've been out of touch. And he goes, it's not as bad because now everybody knows that they got to call in to FWC. And that was one way to do all that.
Plus there's the threat now. They don't know if there's an undercover person.
No, they don't know. Actually, it's funny you mentioned that. A book came out on this.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that. So yeah, please.
It was written by a former school teacher.
Rebecca Renner,
That said just that. She was a school teacher in the east side of Florida somewhere. And that's what prompted this book. One of her students came in and told her, Miss Renner, I'm going to quit all this illegal stuff I'm doing because you don't know who you're dealing with. And she says, what are you talking about? Some really good friends of mine got arrested for collecting alligator eggs. And the guy he was an undercover game warden, and you just don't know who you are. She got so intrigued about that it took her over a year because by then COVID had hit.
So that's what gave her the idea to write the book. I love it.
Yes, she tracked me down. I made the phone call, and I'll be damned, she wrote the book.
Yeah, so listeners or watchers, if you're interested in reading more about this story of this undercover work that Jeff did, the book's called Gator Country. It's by Rebecca Renner. Get it, read it, and it'll go into much more detail about this story. You know, Jeff, just to follow up, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for coming on the program to talk about this. But, you know, your point is well taken that these efforts can deter future crime. And what I have always said is, you know, we're not trying to, we know we're never going to eliminate wildlife trafficking and wildlife crime, but all we have to do is just give animals enough space, enough to outbreed the poachers. That's all they need to be able to do.
Exactly. So. And also keep in mind that, remember, I took over 10,000 hatchlings out of the state of Florida. None of those hatchlings stayed here. So I was afraid of if this practice continued, we're going to go back to trying to save the alligator.
Exactly.
To the endangered species.
Exactly. But, you know. So we keep the pressure on, and we keep the deterrence up. And that's hopefully gives the alligators and all those other species that breathing room they need. Jeff, this was, I know exactly what you went through on this case. I know the frustration, some of the stuff we didn't talk about. And I appreciate the work you did. It's great work. Anytime somebody goes in that deep and lives the life, there's a tremendous impact on your personal life, your personal relationships. We didn't even get into that in this episode. But thank you for the work that you did, and thank you so much for coming on the show to tell us this story. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me, Ed. It's been a pleasure.
You bet. All right, everybody. That brings us to the end of this episode. Stick with us. We've got more episodes, great episodes coming up this season, and take care. Nature Secret Service is written and produced by me, Ed Newcomer, and is co-produced by the DHTV team here at California State University, Dominguez Hills. Follow us on social media and connect with us online at naturesecretservice.com.